Good morning. It's 8:07 on a Tuesday, and of course, that means it's time for On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine, and for the next hour, we'll be talking about your personal finances and giving you lots of advice on how to improve your life financially. Well, Kevin, good morning. Happy New Year. Welcome back. You're back from vacation, and we have another new program for people today.
Good morning, John. I'm glad you didn't say good. You just said new. I appreciate that. I like that in packaging when they put it on the side, when they say new, and you're just supposed to like it and buy it because it is new. So, yes, this is a new show. We will meet that definition.
Well, you know, if you under-promise and over-deliver, that's been my motto for years. Well, thanks to the efforts of all our listeners in exceeding our goals for the last pledge show, we're going to kick off the new year by devoting most of this hour to answering your questions, and here's how we'll do that. You call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. But first, a recent survey revealed some troubling tidbits about the wealth and financial wisdom of Wisconsin residents.
And the survey was conducted, John, by FINRA, which is the Securities Industry Regulation Council, if you will, also in conjunction with the President's Council on Financial Literacy, which our own David Mansell, Wisconsin head of the Jumpstart Coalition, is a member of, and the Department of the Treasury. And what they wanted to measure was not just the financial capability of citizens of America and various states, but also their readiness, what they were doing with their own financial lives that showed that they were on top of things and were in a good position. They did a national survey in 2009, and then they went state by state last month. They released the results, and some fairly interesting things, in not just on a national basis, but also for Wisconsin residents.
Well, how did Wisconsin residents stack up versus the rest of the country?
We didn't do too bad in terms of both habits and practices. One of the questions was spending and saving. How many of the respondents spent more money in a month than they actually had in income? And nationwide, 20% of the respondents said that they spent more money in a given month than they had in income, but only 17% of Wisconsin residents made the same statement. In terms of rainy day funds, this was people who said they had at least 3 months worth of monthly expenses set aside in savings. 39% of Wisconsin residents said that they had that at least that amount set aside. Only 35% of respondents nationwide made that same claim. In terms of non-bank borrowing, this is something that's been in the news a lot. These are people who would go to a payday loan store or a similar higher interest place to get money for the short term. 19% of Wisconsin residents have used some type of service like that in the last year, but only that compares to 24% nationwide. And finally, people who said when they got their last credit card, did you do any shopping around? Did you do any comparison between other credit cards out there? Only 32% of Americans said that they had done that, but 36% of Wisconsinites said that they had actually done some research and looking around before they settled on a particular card.
All right. Well, how did we do in the knowledge department?
Also a little better than the rest of the United States. There are five questions to this quiz, and they're a little tricky. I would be surprised if even the obviously smarter than average and more astute than average On Your Money listenership would get 5 out of 5 on this. But in the United States, generally they got 3 right. Wisconsin residents got 3.1 right on average out of the 5 questions. And if you'd like to try your acumen, we'll have the quiz up at onyourmoney.com, or you can go directly to usfinancialcapability.org to try it yourself.
usfinancialcapability is all one word, .org. Well, I might have to do that. I love taking tests. It's the one thing I miss about going to college. I realize that's rather perverse, but
that's the thing you miss, John.
I miss taking exams. Sorry, it's just the way I am.
Whatever college you went to, I think it may have been the wrong one.
Well, they think it was the wrong one because they keep sending me requests for money and I keep saying no. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to get your financial questions answered today. 800-642-1234. The email address is onyourmoney@WPR.org. But give us a call right now and get your financial questions answered as we move into 2011. What are your concerns and questions? Well, today's the day to get them answered. 800-642-1234. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Well, we've got some questions that have come in via email, Kevin, so let's get to those from the On Your Money email box. A listener from Wales says he is over 60 and has been paying for his son's college by taking taxable distributions from his 401k. He wants to know if, from a tax standpoint, should he continue doing this or take out a loan instead for his son's remaining years of schooling?
Well, actually, he's rightfully concerned about taxes, but there are really three factors in this equation. One is taxes, which he's obviously paying, and this sounds like a bad scenario to some people, but there are tax credits that people, parents or whomever, who are is paying for someone's college costs can use to offset the taxes that he's incurring for pulling this out. Somewhat, not all of the taxes and not in every scenario. More important in this, though, even than the interest, which is what a lot of people would be concerned about if they were to take out a loan, is the actual cash flow. And if he or his son is willing to take out a loan, he can actually solve two of the three problems of taxes, cash flow, and interest cost.
Well, but there is that interest cost.
Right. The nice thing about it, though, with the loan, generally, they can make small payments on the money, and they get it up front. And sometimes with many of these student loans, the payments are foregone for several months or even years while the kid is in school. And even if he pulls out a smaller amount of cash in 401k, that will lower his tax bill. Plus, he will be able to keep more of that money set aside to not only pay for retirement, but also to cover any other expenses that might come up in his or his son's life. Whereas if he hands the money right over to the school right at the beginning of the semester, not only is he automatically on the hook for taxes, but it's difficult to go back to the school and say, hey, we need that money back. Can you give us a student loan instead?
All right. We have some callers lined up, Kevin, so let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Dave in Whitewater. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, really interesting topic you guys are on, something that I've been thinking about quite a bit. I just am a recent college graduate. I graduated in 2009 and lived in Milwaukee for about a year and a half, did a few odd jobs, and I was unemployed for about 4 months, and finally moved back to Whitewater at the last resort for a $10 an hour paid job. And with student loans and everything, I'm barely able to make the bills. And especially with the college prices going up, I'm just wondering, people are making those decisions, what are they thinking?
You mean the decision to borrow money to go to school?
Yes. College prices are going up and up, and I have a lot of friends that are going back to college for their master's, and just to defer their college, their student loan, and they end up just getting more in the hole, and they're just not the jobs when they're coming out.
That part is, I agree with that, and that may not be a permanent condition while the education that they're receiving is permanent. You will always have that master's degree or undergraduate or two-year or technical degree. You will always have that degree. The job market is going to move up and down. The interesting thing about it, what you brought up, is twofold. First of all, the more money that is available, whether it's in the form of grants or loans, generally that increases demand for a college education, which usually, as I remember from my college education, demand increases prices. So it's a vicious cycle. And then, of course, when people say, you know what, I'm not going to work for $10 an hour, I'm just going to go back to school and hopefully better myself and my employability once I get out, that, of course, then boosts the price of the education up even more. So when the opportunity cost of quitting work and going back to school is relatively small, it means that more people are going to do that, which then drives the price up as well. There is some good news in this situation. Again, not just that the education is permanent while the job markets are hopefully temporary. Generally, student loan payments cost about $100 per month for every $1,000 you've borrowed to pay the loan off in 10 years. It's about 1% really of the, or rather $10,000, 1% every single month. So if someone gets out of school and has even $20,000 in student loans, by paying 1% of that amount, about $200 or so every single month, generally that loan will be paid off in 10 years. But when you're out looking for a job and it doesn't seem like it's getting any better, 10 years is a really long time to be stuck with those payments.
Yeah, I remember doing the happy dance when my wife wrote the last check for her graduate student loans. We have a listener named Ole who called in and couldn't stay on the line but wanted to know, Kevin, you said in an earlier show you can give up to $13,000 to your child tax-free. Does that apply to grandchildren as well?
It applies to grandchildren. It applies to anyone, and it's not necessarily that it's tax-free, it's that you just don't incur any gift tax from the IRS. Typically, the IRS, when there is an estate tax in place, is generally concerned about people shifting wealth quickly to children or grandchildren before they die, before the older people die, to avoid the estate taxes. And so they put a limit, the IRS does, puts a limit on the amount of money that can be given to one person in a given year, and it generally is $13,000 that you can give to anyone else without incurring the gift tax in a given year. And for married couples, they get two times $13,000, so they can give $26,000 together to any one individual, and it's not just a grandchild or a family member. That applies to, you know, your neighbor or tipping a waitress or what have you.
$13,000 tip. Boy, that'd be a heck of a meal.
That's good.
let's go to Eagle River next and talk to Kevin. Kevin, good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm a 54-year-old male, and in 2008 was involved in an accident with my semi-truck. It took me out of driving completely, and it's taken me a long time to recover, and the insurance company refused to pay because that accident happened in Illinois. They were from Indiana. I'm a resident of Wisconsin. Because of that, I was going to have to come up with $60,000 just to sue them for my medical, and my medical's well over $100,000. And what I don't know how to do is rebuild my credit. I mean, those bills are out there. My whole credit rating's dropped down to like 516, and I'm unemployable because it affected my spine. And I've applied over 75 to 80 companies that I'm aware of in the trucking industry, as I've been doing that for 30 years. And nobody will hire me because I'm a workman's comp liability issue because of my spine. So I don't know which way to start to rebuild myself up. I'm trying to get my old truck up and running. I found a driver for it, but it's been a struggle, and the church has been helping me financially try to get it up and going. But I don't know the first place to start to get my personal financial going, you know, in a forward direction.
That's a good question, and I'm sorry to hear about your situation. One thing I really do appreciate is that you're still looking for answers with this and trying to get started with that. It's a very tough situation, and I honestly cannot tell you a quick solution to that other than that time is your ally, at least when it comes to building your credit up. It takes a long time usually, even for people who are fortunate enough to bounce back from these types of hits quickly. Many times their financial situation does not mirror their credit score, meaning their financial situation has improved, but the credit score takes a long time to do. If you want to boost up the credit score, I'm not an expert on the trucking business, but I can tell you, go to myfico.com and check the forums out there. It's a pretty good website that not only gives you your credit score for a fee, but there are a lot of really wise people who are willing to share information about their experiences about building up credit and hopefully give you some things that can at least get that part of your life back on track.
Kevin, thanks for your call, and good luck getting yourself back on track financially and back in business. If you'd like to get some financial advice from Kevin McKinley, you can call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. There are lines available for you if you call right now. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Give me some money. It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley on this Tuesday morning, the 4th of January, 2011. John Munson in for Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Well, Kevin, we're going to dip into the On Your Money email bag again, and this time it's Dave in Madison who has this question. He says he moved most of his IRA money into a GNMA, Ginnie Mae mutual fund that now comprises over half of his net worth. He's concerned about rising interest rates hurting the value of the fund and wonders if he should take it out or keep it in there. Well, first of all, Kevin, what's a Ginnie Mae mutual fund?
It's geared toward people who are interested in income and who are willing to take a little bit of risk to get more income than very safe investments can provide. Ginnie Mae, they're basically government-backed mortgages, meaning they're mortgages that have been lent out to individuals, but the government guarantees that if the individuals can't pay it, the government will pay the bondholders back. They offer about a 4% yield or so right now, and even through the housing crisis, they've been relatively stable. There's been some up and downs in the values of the securities and mutual funds that invest in them, but it's still been fairly calm compared to what one might expect if they had seen in advance what the markets were going to do in the real estate area.
Well, that doesn't sound too bad.
No, but Dave is right to be concerned about rising interest rates because Ginnie Mae securities have been around for a very long time, but most of the last three decades has been a climate of interest rates falling. And generally, bond prices go up in value when interest rates are falling. They go down in value when interest rates are rising. That's the first risk in this type of fund, is that they may be a long-term investor and be able to hang on to this fund indefinitely. But if other people in the fund aren't as brave as he is, they might start pulling their money out of the fund if interest rates rise, forcing the fund managers to sell the securities within the fund at lower prices, which will then lower the net asset value, which then causes even more people to panic to a certain extent, which then causes more sales, which then leads to lower prices. So even if he's strong enough to weather this out, other people might not be, and when they pull their money out, it'll affect the net asset value of the fund.
But rates might stay low or go even lower.
Yeah, that could definitely happen, and it's probably, unless there is some kind of quick crisis, that's probably the most likely scenario. But even then, that can create a different problem, and because rates are so low and can't go a whole lot lower, this isn't as likely or as likely to be as dramatic. But these are mortgages, so homeowners, when interest rates go down, have a tendency to refinance, and then they pay off the old mortgage, which is then distributed to the fund share owners, in this case Dave, and then within his account, the mortgage buyers within the mutual fund are forced to rebuy new mortgages at lower interest rates, which creates another potential for a crisis if and when interest rates do rise again.
So do you think Dave should get rid of his Ginnie Mae mutual fund?
Not necessarily. I think it can be a nice piece for a more conservative investor as part of the portfolio, but he might want to scale back his exposure so he doesn't have as much of it of his net worth and his assets put into this type of fund. If he wants to move towards safety, he can get certificates of deposit that, if he's willing to go out a few years, he can get 2 to maybe 3% interest, and I think rates might become more attractive on those over the coming year. If he wants something that he has a little bit more risk but a lot more potential for reward, he might even look at stocks, because stocks will be much more volatile than Ginnie Mae securities and have a bigger potential for risk in the short term, but they also offer much more potential for reward over the long term than these Ginnie Mae securities do.
All right. This is your chance during On Your Money to get your questions answered. We're spending most of the program taking your calls and email questions. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, just like Fred in Lakewood did. Fred, good morning.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Go ahead,
Fred.
Please.
My question?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, okay. I'm approaching 62, and my wife is older than me, and she has been a stay-at-home mom, although she's had some income, and she's now she's at 64, is getting her a check for, for some money. But I was looking at your Social Security Strategies pamphlet, and it talks about the possibility of file and suspend. I'm thinking of filing at 62, in order for her to receive up to half my benefits. However, by doing that, I'm wondering if I would lose the opportunity of my Social Security income to be higher if I wait till 65 or 66 or later. And I guess I'm wondering, if I do this file and suspend, will I lose the opportunity for my Social Security to be higher if I wait?
That's a great question. To do the file and suspend, you generally have to be at least the normal retirement age. The tactic, and for you, I'm guessing it's probably 66, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. The file and suspend basically allows an individual, and it usually is the person with the higher Social Security benefit, where that person files so that within... Typically, it's a male, but not always, obviously. That, let's say the husband files, and so that his wife can get half of his benefit in the form of the spousal benefit. And then he suspends his benefit so that she starts getting some cash in, but then he can start ramping up. He gets an 8% increase, obviously, for every year that he waits. And the advantage of that, of course, is you get some money now, but then you also can get a higher benefit down the road. And I would prefer, I don't think that's the worst idea for your situation if it's possible, but the question is if it's possible. The other question is do you have other money on which to live to cover your living expenses? And then how much will that be worth once you actually do initiate your own Social Security benefits, Fred? Meaning, let's say, I'm not going to force you to reveal your situation, but let's say you had $300,000 in an IRA or retirement account, and you plan on drawing that down and living off of it while you wait for your Social Security check to increase 8% every single year. That's a really good idea on paper, and you can run spreadsheets from here to Sunday that will show you that this is probably the smartest move. The problem is, of course, if you draw down your liquid savings and then turn the switch on for Social Security, that'll work as long as you have nothing bad or good that requires you to write a big check, because you can't call up Social Security and say, hey, we had an emergency here. I need $100,000 that I spent in the last few years. Can you send me my next 36 checks or whatever in advance? Because they won't do that, and it's difficult to borrow against that. So I would prefer for many people that they still take Social Security earlier and keep their liquid assets more sacred for emergencies and to live off of down the road, rather than trying to keep building up this checkoff in the future. Again, on paper, it's better to wait, but in life and from a liquidity standpoint, you're probably better off taking it sooner and keeping your savings set aside.
Fred in Lakewood, thank you very much. Well, this is our morning for Fred's, because we have an email from Fred in Baraboo, and it's actually in some ways a similar question. Fred says, my wife and I are both over 65. We have money in a deferred compensation fund accumulated during the time we worked in county government. Is there a way to determine the amount of the money we could take out of the fund without incurring a huge tax bite on our regular retirement pension?
Yes, actually, and it comes comes down to line 43 on their taxes, on their 1040, which is on the back page. And what people in the situation, if I understand Fred number two's situation correctly, is you want to keep that that figure on line 43 at $68,000 or below. And the reason $68,000 is important is because that's where the tax brackets jump from 15% at the federal level up to 25%. So Fred number two and all other people in his situation should try to manage their income so they can hopefully stay below $68,000 on line 43. And they should also take more money maybe than they even need on which to live to get to that $68,000 point every single year. Now, that requires a lot of work, and it requires some last-minute calculations sometimes, especially in this past year when we weren't even sure what 2011 tax numbers were going to be up until a couple weeks ago. But that is a way that he can mitigate the taxes down the road but still get money set aside. And as long as it's not a required minimum distribution that he would have to take at 70, or 70 and a half rather, he can roll that money over into a Roth IRA that he doesn't need, the difference between what he had to spend on which to live and the $68,000 figure. He can roll that over into a Roth IRA, and then it will continue to grow tax-deferred, and any future distributions will not make Social Security taxable from that Roth IRA, and there's no mandatory distribution on it. So that's a very tricky but a very wise strategy to manage the income distributions from that plan to stay in the lower tax bracket.
Thanks to Fred and Baraboo for that email. Lines available for you right now to call in with your questions about personal finance for Kevin McKinley on Your Money today here on the Ideas Network. Here is the phone number, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to ask your question and get some personal financial advice from Kevin McKinley here on Your Money on the Ideas Network. Well, we have another emailer who, a guy named John, well, to start with, what a great name. He says he loves your show. Well, there's two things in his favor, and he wonders if you saw the recent episode of 60 Minutes that warned of the looming troubles that states and municipalities are facing. He would like to know what you think the implications will be if that scenario comes true.
Well, first of all, yes, he does get a pass in because his name is John. And second of all, he did heap false praise on me and the show. And as both the regular listeners to On Your Money know, that's the best way to get your question answered for free. I'm surprised, actually, that all these other Freds and Olies and Kevins got in without boosting up my ego.
A Kevin would have been, you know, that's okay.
I'd let it slide just this once.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the problem, as stated on the 60 Minutes segment, and it was called the Day of Reckoning. If it wasn't alarming enough, it's that there's lower tax revenue into municipalities, whether it's state or local or on specific projects, whether that's due to sales taxes, income taxes, property taxes. All of those numbers are generally lower and trending downward. In the meantime, many of these municipalities and projects have higher expenses, including unfunded pension and health care liabilities for their current workers and their retired workers. So what the inference from this segment was that people who had lent money to these municipalities in the form of buying their bonds were not going to get all of the money back promised to them because these municipalities wouldn't be able to cover all the expenses and issue all the new debt to refinance the bonds as well. The phrase used was default, and the other phrase was a wave of defaults, meaning there were going to be hundreds of defaults across the country from municipalities, whether it's state or local or projects, that weren't going to be able to pay their debts. And ironically, interest rates, which many retired people hope go up in value so they can get a higher yield, if interest rates go higher, that might make it more likely that these projects and municipalities and bond issuers do actually default.
Okay, so that sounds fairly ominous.
Yeah, and it actually, it's not impossible for it to happen, but in the wake of this report, other pundits weighed in and said, well, for now, we've got the federal government helping out many of these municipalities. Revenue is improving marginally and in a year-over-year basis, but the tax revenue is up, reflecting increased activity, especially on a sales basis. If interest rates stay low, and if taxes do go higher, especially on a national basis, which many people are predicting, that actually will keep demand high for these tax-free bonds that have been issued and will help support the prices, at least for the time being.
So you're not worried about the financial health of these municipalities?
I'm probably not as worried about it as as anyone who watched the 60 Minutes segment would be, but that said, there is no denying that there are long-term structural issues here, which really it's just a matter of when the problems occur, not if they occur. And I think it's going to be done by everyone's going to feel a little bit of pain rather than just the bondholders getting clobbered from a default from the municipalities. You might see higher taxes. You're definitely going to see lower spending. You're going to see a lot of layoffs and cutbacks on hiring at the state and local level. The bondholders have already experienced some pain over this report and the other facts surrounding backing up the support, because bond prices on tax-free bonds anyway have dropped significantly over the last few months.
All right, Kevin, thanks for answering that question for John. And your question could be next at 800-642-1234. It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Fox Lake next. Take a call from June. June, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes. Okay. I took $130,000 out of my IRA 2 years ago to put a down payment on a house. I just got a notice from the Social Security office that my Social Security is going to be reduced by $236 a month, because that showed up as an increase in income. You know, I don't understand this, because I paid the taxes on it, and now it seems like I'm again paying, and I just wanted your comment on that.
How old are you, June?
I am 68 years old.
68.
And I am a widow, and, I took it out to put a down payment on a house. I did go to Social Security. They told me there were only four reasons that they could defer this, and one was loss of income, divorce, or death. Well, my husband died 5 years ago. So I'm just wondering, do you have any suggestions? Or
so they told go back for a second. Excuse me.
Yeah,
so
sure.
They said that this was because of that huge, significant amount of money that you took out of this IRA. They targeted towards that, correct?
Yes, and they said they didn't have anything to do with it, but the IRS mm-hmm. notified them that I had a jump in income. Now, they did tell me that after a year, if I could prove that my income went down, then they would readjust it. I've never taken money out of my IRA before. I didn't know this could happen. Nobody told me this. The bottom line is, he said some kind of a law came in 2007, and it's now just being implemented.
Hmm. And so they were saying that because of this huge income, you were going to get a reduction in the Social Security. Now, is it reduction, an actual reduction in the check, or is it an increase in the required withholding?
No, it's actual reduction of my monthly benefit.
And it's just a straight Social Security payment?
Yep.
Hmm.
And, the bottom line is I went to him, and as I said, the only reason I could get out of it were those three reasons.
And I'm sorry, say again the three reasons, June?
A divorce, death, or loss of income.
Hmm.
And there was one other I don't quite remember, but those were three of them.
Well, I tell you what, I don't have an answer for you on this in a way that that I would feel comfortable without you giving out more information about your situation than I think you would prefer to do over the air. If you want to send your question into Kevin at onyourmoney.com, I'll try to answer it the best that I can and do a little research on it as well. But I think there's more going on here than either you've been told or you've been made to understand, but I'd like to get more background on it before I would say for sure. Now, that said, let me go back to something here. You took $130,000 out of your IRA as a down payment on the house. Was that a 10 or 20% down payment, or did you just take it out because you wanted to?
I wanted to get the payment on my house down.
Mm.
So I took out more. It was more. Definitely was more. It was like it was a little more than half down on the house.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now I'm working for $8.25 an hour, you know, and I'm making ends meet without trying not to take anything out of my IRA.
Right.
You know, because I don't want to be penalized, and now this has really got me scared.
Yeah. I don't blame you for being upset about that. I will say this, and hindsight's 20/20, and there are certainly some benefits to doing this. But for other people who are listening, if you ever come across the same situation, try to avoid doing the same thing. Not so much because of the taxes and the penalties, but again because of the liquidity. When you use up $130,000 just to get your payments down, you're just shifting money from your liquid assets into your illiquid assets, which are your house. And one thing I would definitely have you do, June, I would have encouraged you to not do that, to put down as little as possible as the bank would have allowed you to use to purchase the home. But now that you do have that, please make sure that you not only establish but maintain a home equity line of credit for as much as you can, so that if some other emergency comes up, you can hopefully write a check against that home equity without pulling a huge the rest of your IRA money out and using up all of your liquidity. So do whatever you can to get a home equity line of credit, and then keep it open for as much and as long as you possibly can.
June, thanks for that call. You're listening to On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner and Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash.
It's On Your Money with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner and Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. He's here to take your questions about personal finance, and let's go right back to the phones. Chris in Rio, you'll be next. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good so far, but the day is young. What's your question for Kevin?
I'm about to be 65. I turn 65 in a month. I'm currently employed, and I'm wondering if I should start taking my Social Security payment now or wait until I'm 66.
Do you need the money to survive, Chris?
No, I can. What I was thinking about doing is investing it as a, you know, some kind of a balanced fund for, you know, retirement.
I would say that probably isn't the best reason to do it. You can do it. It's not the worst reason to do it. I would say only do it if you need it to live, because, and again, it's not so much because I think that a balanced fund is a great or a terrible idea for the short term. It's that you are probably going to pay a significant amount of income tax on that Social Security when it's combined with your earnings. And if you hold off when you take it, not only will you get more money by waiting a year, but you'll pay probably much less in taxes because you won't have your earned income piled up on top of the Social Security. Plus, you may lose some benefits based on the amount of earnings you have. If it's over, I think, $14,260 or something like that, and you're under normal retirement age, you tend to lose a dollar for every $2 you make over that particular amount. So between the taxes, between the increased benefit, and between the potential reduction if you're under normal retirement age, that will more than offset any gain you're going to get from a fairly conservative, balanced fund.
Chris, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I'm wondering if I should wait until I'm 70 then, if I continue to work.
Yeah, actually, I think you should. That's not a bad idea. And the nice thing about it is it'll always be there for you. Social Security, with all the problems it has and the potential shortfall, Social Security is still the most predictable source of income in retirement. And with the average check running somewhere, you know, $1,100 to $1,200 per month, and retirees living for roughly 20 years, this is a $200,000 or $300,000 pot from which you can draw. And I would definitely recommend you don't take it until you actually need the money to live, and then go ahead and trigger the payments.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Rochester, Minnesota next and talk with Sue. Sue, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, we hear you just fine.
Okay. The reason why I'm calling is we're 60 years old, and I invented a product, and we went bankrupt doing it, so we gave up our house. We talked to credit sponsors. We filed bankruptcy. We moved to a cottage that we have in the country that has no running water or septic, so we're doing the outhouse thing. Right now, our income is about Social Security level. We have no medical insurance, so we're basically living kind of day-to-day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what our next step should be, if we should take early Social Security and retire because that's what we're making now, or if how do we proceed from here because we're basically starting over.
Right. And I'm sorry, how old did you say you were, Sue?
We're 60.
Okay, so you still have a couple years until you can take Social Security, correct?
Right.
Okay. Well, I would definitely encourage you to take it. If you need the money to survive, I would definitely encourage you to trigger and get whatever benefits you can. And use that to, if you don't need it to live, you should use it to build your savings back up. Now, one of the issues, of course, as you recognize, is that you won't qualify for Medicare for health insurance until you turn 65, health insurance from the government. You may look at, I'm not sure in Minnesota, but I know Wisconsin has some lower income or high-risk health insurance that can be purchased, but it's fairly expensive, especially if you're living fairly hand-to-mouth right now. That said, from what you've been able to tell me, I would definitely encourage you to take what you can get from Social Security, what you don't need to spend to live, use that to pile up on your savings, or maybe purchase health coverage if you can get that.
Sue, thanks for the call, and good luck going forward. Here's a comment from Facebook this morning from Donna. Donna says, I have two CDs coming due this month, and the interest rates have dropped really low. I am trying to decide how long to extend them. At what point do you see interest rates finally rising?
As I mentioned, I think rates will be higher at some point this year than they are right now. But that said, CD holders, and I'm a fan of CDs for a very conservative investment, but the way that you maximize your yield from them is to take it out for as long as you possibly can get it, as long as the penalty for early withdrawal is usually only 6 months or less. In some cases, it might be a year or so. But if you take out, let's say your choices are a 1% CD for a year or a 3% CD for 3 years, and neither one offers a 6% penalty for early withdrawal. Well, if rates go up and you take out the 3% CD, you can pull it out and pay the penalty and then renew someplace else at the higher interest rate. But if rates stay the same or go down, in the meantime, you're still going to be getting a much higher rate than if you just tried to keep rolling them over on a smaller yield and to try to keep it liquid. So I would generally encourage Donna to go out as long as possible and just make sure that there is only a 6 month or less penalty for early withdrawal. Some institutions offer longer ones with a year penalty. Again, I'm okay with that because you know what the penalty is going to be in advance.
All right. Thanks, Donna, for that comment. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Carolyn in La Crosse.
Hello. Thank you. The Federal Reserve is putting $600 billion somehow into the economy, mm-hmm. and it said that that might lower interest rates. Is that just for people who are way underwater with their mortgages, or would that be coming in for people who are trying to do a refinance on their house?
That's a great question, Carolyn. Ostensibly, what's happening is the Federal Reserve has announced a program to systematically put money through the primary dealers buying Treasury securities, which ostensibly is going to lower interest rates because it's going to increase bond prices. Ironically, interest rates have gone up since they put that program in place, not to a great degree, but it's gone up. Some people say There are a lot of reasons it could have happened, but some people say, well, it's because they are printing more money, if you will, to a certain extent, and which increases the debt that the U.S. is incurring, which then increases the interest rate that people need to receive before they're willing to lend money back to the United States. Not sure if that's true or if that's the reason behind it, but that's what's happened. They have helped subsidize the housing market so that interest rates can stay artificially low on longer-term mortgages. That may continue, but so far it looks like rates have started to creep back up to where they would be in a vacuum if there weren't efforts going on for it. But yes, it's hopefully helping everybody. But the problem is that there still is a huge gap between the people who want to borrow money and can afford to pay it back and the banks that are willing to lend money to people. That seems to be narrowing. Banks seem to be opening up their purse strings a little bit. People seem to be more interested in borrowing money maybe than they would have been a year ago at this time. But the efforts, I'm not sure you can credit the efforts for it, but that's what they're going to take credit for it anyway, so you might as well give them a pat on the back.
Well, Kevin, just to clarify, that money that the Fed is putting in, they're not dumping that into the mortgage market. That's money that's available for banks to lend to businesses, for capital improvements, things like that. And it's not, they're not dumping that money directly into the mortgage market.
Well, they are purchasing securities above and beyond just straight treasuries. That much I know. I don't know how much, and I don't know which securities. I wouldn't be surprised if actually that were going on. There's going to be a lot of discussion over not just the Federal Reserve, but what the duties and obligations and privileges are enjoyed by that organization, and whether it's something that definitely serves the American people to the extent, or if it's something that it's a tremendous amount of cost, it's benefiting a relatively small portion of the population.
All right, Caroline, thanks for that call. Kevin, we have a lot of websites of the week this week. Teresa wants to know what website she can visit to freeze her credit report.
It's the best protection against identity theft. What Teresa could do is she should go to each bureau's website, each of the three biggest credit bureaus, and send them a letter to freeze the report. There's a small fee to do so and a small fee to reopen it and then refreeze it again. But she can also go to the State of Wisconsin website. It's privacy.wi.gov, and there is a letter template there that people can use to send to the credit bureaus. Just change the information. I think it's even in a Word document, and send it along with their fee, and that generally should freeze her credit reports at the biggest bureaus.
All right. Carol is trying to opt out of direct mailings, but is concerned about entering her Social Security number to do so.
Yeah, we get this one a lot, and the problem is the Direct Marketing Association would set up this website. For some reason, they need to know that you really are who you say you are, and they can't believe you wouldn't want all this junk mail, so you need to verify it. But yes, if she goes to optoutprescreen.com, that's a legitimate website, optoutprescreen.com, she will be required to enter her Social Security number, but it is as safe as any other place that holds your Social Security number, and it will substantially reduce the amount of junk mail she receives.
And several listeners have asked you to repeat the website that tells you the most efficient way to travel from one place to another.
Well, that one was called Get Set, and for better or for worse, they just went off the web recently. But there is a better one out there called TravelMath.com. TravelMath.com not only allows you to calculate the most cost-efficient form of transportation, whether it's car, bus, plane, train, whatever, or weigh your carbon footprint of taking a trip from one place to the other, search for hotel rooms nearby, TravelMath.com. And all of the websites that we mentioned today, John, will be up at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
You have a quick New Year's resolution for us financially this year, Kevin?
Well, it's two. You should spend less, and then you will therefore have more.
That sounds like four words to live by. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thank you, John.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money on LLC, appears on the Ideas Network every Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock. This program was produced by Rob Ferret. Chris Molina handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. One more reminder, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.